Yeah, thank you. Well, welcome to this breakout session on addressing child mental health needs across cultures. I'd like to give a little background on who I am so you kind of know where I'm coming from as I present this topic. So my name is Helene Joder. I'm originally from the Netherlands. I did a master's in clinical child and family studies at Utrecht University in the Netherlands and worked for a while in outpatient mental health in the Netherlands and then went to Sierra Leone. And more recently, I completed a PhD in global child and adolescent mental health at the University of Amsterdam, again in the Netherlands. I worked in Sierra Leone in West Africa since 2003 till 2015 in the urban context of Freetown, the capital. And then I came back 2017 to 2020 to work in a more rural context, a small mission hospital. I've worked both at a community-based level, with just down close to the people, and also on like the more national level, helping out with mental health policy development for the country, and also the founding of a mental health coalition for Sierra Leone. And then also I worked both in emergency response. When I came in 2003, the war was just over. And the country was completely devastated. There were a lot of child soldiers. There was a lot of trauma. And then in 2014, 2015, I worked with Save the Children in the Ebola response when we had the Ebola pandemic in Sierra Leone. So that's a bit where I come from. So I've seen both worlds, emergency and development, and the grassroots and the government level. So that's where I come from. I would like to give a little bit of context first to the topic of child and adolescent mental health, because it's a very young field of study, and where we come from is the context of transcultural psychiatry and global mental health. In the 20th century, when it all started with psychiatrists and cultural psychiatrists and epidemiologists. And we had what we called an emic or an etic approach. I don't know if people have heard about this. These are anthropological terms. We had the people coming from an emic approach. Those were the anthropologists and the cultural psychiatrists. And they looked at mental disorders as something that was shaped by cultural forces. So they looked at the uniqueness of mental disorders in different cultures. But then we also had the epidemiologists and the clinicians. And they looked at mental disorders as something that's not much biologically different from other medical disorders, and they looked at mental disorders as a universal phenomenon. So they looked at more from the universal perspective. So these were two different approaches, but then from the 1970s, they started working together more and appreciating each other and seeing that actually we need to look at mental health from both perspectives. And so that the collaboration between these two approaches led to the development of the global mental health movement. Now, there were also four very transformational shifts from the 1970s till now. And the first one was that it shifted the whole field of global mental health, shifted from a biomedical approach that looked at mental health as a purely medical problem to the biopsychosocial approach, where there was much more attention given to the social determinants of mental health. Another shift was the institutional to community care. I think we all know the stories. If you look at Sierra Leone, there's one very old, big mental hospital that was founded by the British. And that was mental health in Sierra Leone. If you had a mental disorder, that's where you went. But it has shifted much more now to community care. The third shift was the shift from experts to a variety of providers. So the traditional experts were psychiatrists. Mental health meant psychiatry. But now it's a much more a variety of mental health care providers, mental health specialists, but also involvement of lay people and general health providers. And the fourth shift was the inclusion of those with lived experiences. It's the new adage of like nothing about us without us. Now we include people with mental disorders in developing mental health care. So those are the four transformational shifts that took place over the last part of the last century. And this was buttressed by research evidence in four domains. So there was a lot of research coming up that looked at, for example, the social determinants and determinants of mental health. There's a very strong connection between social disadvantage and poor mental health. And I think we find out more and more that social disadvantage can lead to mental health disorders, and then mental health disorders can then lead to social disadvantage. So there's a strong connection between, if we want, for example, if we want to fight poverty, we need to actually address mental health. The next area that was researched was the global burden of disease that was attributable to mental disorders. If anybody was in Dr. Raj's presentation earlier this afternoon, he talked about this, how mental disorders are, that was the video of Vikram Patel, where he talked about how the global burden of disease attributable to mental disorders is very large. And it's actually growing, especially if you look at, for example, substance use disorders. Then the next area that has been researched more is, we found that there's a lot of inadequate investment in mental health care. Even though there's a large burden of disease, there's usually very, very small budget allocations to mental health. So people do, governments do not spend money on mental health. And the last finding in the research was that there is near absence of access to quality care globally. In many, we get back to that, but in many countries there is hardly any mental health care available. So these four areas of research led to the development of the emergence of the global mental health movement. And in 2007, the Lancet series on global mental health concluded that there is actually a global health crisis when it comes to mental health, because there's a high burden of disease and there's a large treatment gap. And then the Lancet series called for actions to reduce the treatment gap. And that's what we call, and Dr. Reitz referred to that as well, the MH gap. So we try to close the gap in treatment for mental health disorders. So this is just to give you the bigger picture of child and adolescent mental health. Now, since then, the WHO and other large organizations have responded to this need with various publications, and I don't have time to go into all of them, but I just want to highlight a few, because if you're interested in this field, these are definitely the documents you need to look up. And the first one is the MH Gap Humanitarian Intervention Guide for the Clinical Management of Mental, Neurological, and Substance Use Conditions. And it says in humanitarian emergencies, but it's actually something that is used in many countries around the world now as the guidelines for the treatment of mental disorders. Another important document that came out was the Building Back Better document of WHO. And this is talking about how a crisis can also be an opportunity. So even though, if a country goes through a major crisis, for example, the Ebola pandemic or a war, after that there's usually a lot of money available for relief, and this is an opportunity to start working towards building back better, and that's why it's called building back better, a better mental health care system in the country. So this document, you can download it from the WHO website, and it gives a lot of suggestions, ideas, and guidelines on how to build a better mental health system. Another one important document is the IASC guidelines on mental health and psychosocial support in emergency settings. Again, it's very easy to download if you Google it, and it gives you guidelines if you're working in emergency settings on how to do mental health and psychosocial care. How many people are in this room are familiar with this pyramid? I just was curious. Okay, that's quite a few. So, but I still, since many people didn't raise their hand, this is also was developed by the WHO, and it explains how actually in every country there is a large group of people with mild mental health problems, and so that's at the bottom of the pyramid. You see the self-care and the informal community care. These mild mental disorders do not need to be addressed by specialists. They can be addressed by community care. They can, for example, be easily addressed in churches. They can be addressed by lay people. But then as you move up the pyramid, there's less and less people, but these people have more serious problems, and they need to be taken care of by mental health care professionals. And only at the top we see the long-stay facilities and the specialist services. This is actually only a very small group of people, the people with schizophrenia, the people with bipolar disorders, and that need specialist care and that may need admission temporarily. So this is the very expensive care, but at the bottom that's the low-cost care. So this was what WHO developed as a guideline for countries to start moving away from the institutional care and investing less money in institutional care and investing more money in community care. And again, if you were at Dr. Raj's presentation, he gave a beautiful example of that. So lastly, I think I want to mention here in this big context of global mental health that there are some very promising developments. And the first one is the whole development. I think everybody is, you know, we are now talking a lot about neuroscience and what that means for mental health care. And I think there's a danger there to move back to this idea of, well, if it's related, if it's in the brain, then it must be universal. And I think what we are learning more and more, also with the neuroanthropology, is that actually our brain is also shaped by culture. So even if we can see a connection between our brain and mental health disorders, that doesn't mean that it manifests itself the same in different cultures. So this is a very interesting field that is very, very young and completely in development. And the next development I think that is, I think, promising is a critical review of the DSM-5 that has been going on also already with the DSM-4. I think we have to realize that the DSM and the ICD, they were developed in Western context in America and Europe. And so they make the experience of Caucasian people, American people, European people central to the diagnosis in mental health. So we make that the standard and then look at what deviates from that, and which is more and more criticized. So, and I think that's a good thing. So this is just to give you the bigger picture of global mental health, and then I would like to go now to the topic for today, which is global child and adolescent mental health. Now, if you think that the field of global mental health is young, the field of global child and adolescent mental health is even younger. We are still learning a lot of things. Just a few numbers. Children in low and middle-income countries are often affected by accumulating risk factors. Poverty, violence, malnutrition, poor health, they can all lead to mental health disorders, especially when they accumulate, of course. And so the prevalence rates that we have come up with so far are 8 to 26% across the world. Now, it's very difficult to really know how many people are having mental health disorders in the world, because most of the research that's done is done in Western countries, while 80% of the children and adolescents of this world live in low and middle income countries, and that's where we have very little research. So we sort of base it on what we see in Western countries, but we do not really know what is going on in many other parts of the world. Another thing is that it's very difficult to measure child and adolescent mental health disorders. Because how do we measure? What instruments do we use? Can we use our instruments from America and just translate them and use them in Africa or Asia? I don't think so, and I think you'll probably agree with that. There was, just to give you an example, there was a study done in Sierra Leone where they studied children without parental support. It was about 6 years after the war, and the study said that 75% of these adolescents had PTSD and 80% major depressive disorder. 75 and 80% is extremely high, and I think the moment you see these numbers, you need to ask questions like, are we really measuring what we think we are measuring? They said 70% of the teenagers were at high risk of suicide. I have lived in Sierra Leone for 14 years. I've seen about 2 suicides in those years. Suicide is not a big issue in Sierra Leone. I'm not saying there are not problems. There are major mental health problems, but I do not think we can use the Western descriptions that we have to describe what's going on there. So sometimes it can be very unhelpful, and so that's, I will talk a little more about it later. But despite the immense needs, the child and adolescent mental health care in many low-resource countries is very minimal, and the treatment gaps are up to 99%, which is basically means like nobody is getting the care they need, or hardly anybody. why should we be concerned about child mental health? I think there are several reasons. The first one is that we think in the area of primary prevention, we can prevent a lot of mental disorders by addressing child mental health. If we do this at a young age, we may have a lot less mental health problems in adults. So this is the primary prevention, but also secondary prevention, because up to 50% of adult mental disorders starts before the age of 14 years. So if we can begin to address these mental disorders and treat them at an early age, we can also prevent them from getting worse. So that's another reason. The third reason, which is a very strong reason for me, is the Christian mandate to take care of children and young people. And also because mental health is so connected with spiritual health. And if people and if children and adolescents are struggling with depression and trauma, it's very difficult for them to have a healthy spiritual life as well. So I think there's also very, very strong reason for us as Christians to address child and adolescent mental health, to help children and adolescents to develop a healthy relationship with Jesus. Now, the main approach around the world for solving this treatment gap has been the integration into primary healthcare. And since we are at the Medical Missions Conference, that's probably, many of you will probably have this this approach to mental health, is that we can integrate mental health into primary healthcare. And there definitely is a place for that, and it's been done in many places now, especially in adult mental health care. But I think we still need to think this through for adolescent and child mental health, whether that really is the best place for us to offer mental health care. One of the problems that we see, and I think Dr. Raj talked a lot about task sharing, or task shifting, where we train nurses, for example, and doctors, and in Sierra Leone is also the community health workers. We train them in mental health so that they can also provide mental health care, which is a good thing, I believe. What I've also seen is that everybody seems to come with this concept now of task shifting and task sharing. So we see nurses now being trained in eye health, in epilepsy care, in many other fields, and so there's more and more pressure on health professionals to provide a large variety of healthcare. So, and child and adolescent mental health is a field that it's not just medical. It's not just a matter of diagnosing and prescribing medication. It's actually with children and adolescents, it's much more. Working with families, you are looking at education, you are looking at a much wider, there's many more needs than just the medical needs. And a lot of the childhood mental disorders are not treated with medication. So there's limitations to what we can do in the healthcare sector. But it doesn't mean we cannot do it. It just means that we need to be aware of that. Also, if we take an exclusive health approach, we may hinder the development of healthcare in other fields, like in education or in the justice system or in the religious system. So I'll come back to that as well. So it's important to remember that some of the most pertinent actions for child and adolescent mental health, they are actually not in the field of mental health, but outside. So if we really want to prevent children to develop mental health problems, we probably need to look at the educational system, and we probably need to look at poverty. And so we need to look at other fields. So it may feel like this is not mental health, but it is, because it's all these fields are interrelated. And for example, an important issue in across Africa is the physical discipline, which is a major problem in schools and in homes. And if we do not address that from a child protection standpoint, then that will also lead to a mental health disorder. So we need to work together with different fields. Now, to make it a little bit more practical, what does child mental health mean, and what does it look like? And I can share a little bit from my experience in Sierra Leone. And I'm sure that as you work in different countries, you will come up with different examples. A few examples. The first child is Anne, and you see me in the left, like earlier years when I first came to Sierra Leone. I think it was within the first three to six weeks. We worked in the prisons there. It was just after the war. And one day I entered the prison, and I found this tiny little girl locked in a room by herself, rocking back and forth, sitting covered in diarrhea, and she was left there, and nobody really knew anything about her. And so we cleaned her up, we got her out, got her treated for her diarrhea, and now what do we do with this child? Now, she was nonverbal, she didn't say anything, she would eat anything that came close to her, whether it was food or not. From my perspective, I had just come to Sierra Leone. I thought, is this trauma? Is this autism? Is this intellectual disability? What is this? And the people around me, they knew what it was. It was a devil child. So this was one child. I'm not going to tell you the whole story because then I don't have time. But that's an example. That's how we find children that are so out of our comfort zone, situations that so, and we, how do we interpret this and how do we best help these children? Another child was Muhammad Ali. He was my neighbor. He was a little boy, probably about 5 years old, and he had severe behavioral problems. And I asked his grandmother about it, and she said, well, it's his name. You know, Muhammad Ali is such a big name, and it's too big for him to carry. And he cannot handle that, and so that's why he's behaving like this. What should we do? Change his name? I don't know. Abu is another boy that was brought to me, and when I was working with him, I was really surprised to see that he had earrings, like he had little holes in his earlobes, and that's very unusual because that is the way to, like, girl children will get earrings when they are very small, maybe 7-8 days old. That's how you see it's a girl. But this boy, what happened? And so when I asked, they said, well, all his siblings that were born before him, they were boys and they died. So we dressed him and we treated him like a girl for the first, like, 4 years of his life. So the spirits wouldn't think that he is a boy and they wouldn't kill him. He survived, but he had a lot of problems. Did it have anything to do with the fact that he was treated like a girl? I don't know. Mariama was a teenage girl when I first met her, and she told me that when she was 5 years old, she met a spirit, and she continued meeting with him. He was sort of a friend. They met up, and that she was very little, and continued till she was a teenager. And then she moved to a different area of town, and she didn't tell him. Now, he came back. He found her, and ever since, he throws her down twice a week, and she has a seizure. And that's what happens. And this is what's causing her seizures. I see lots of puzzled faces. Yes, I was very puzzled by these situations too. What do you say? What do you do? Okay, Fatmata. First Fatmata. Fatmata, you see her in the bottom left. She is a girl who is in our program currently in Sierra Leone. She's about 7 years old. Oh no, a bit older. Probably 10 years old by now. When she was 5 years old, she was a healthy young girl. When she was 5 years old, she had malaria and was in a coma for a while. Now when you meet her, she completely behaves and acts like a child with autism. So, and I've seen that a lot in Sierra Leone, that children who have severe malaria later develop autism. So this is a complete new field that we don't know much about yet. So, and then I have said that the witch children, these are three little boys, or two boys and a girl, and I did a big research study in Sierra Leone on witchcraft and children, because a lot of children say they are witches. And why do children say they are witches? And so, if you're interested in that, I did a paper on that. And if you go online to our session, there's a recommended literature document that you can download, and there's some literature on there. I did a paper on witchcraft and children. Now, when I interviewed these children, I found out there's a lot of distress in their environment. And so what we did, instead of saying witchcraft doesn't exist, or witchcraft, witch children don't exist, now, I think that many of us as Christians will say, yes, witchcraft exists, but do we believe that a five-year-old can kill his mother? Or is there maybe something else going on? So what we did is we interviewed these children, and rather than saying, no, this is not witchcraft, we said, let's look at this from a mental health perspective. And can we maybe explain what happened and what he is saying in a different way, rather than denying it's witchcraft, saying, what's going on in the life of this little boy? And so we found out that these children that were brought to the church as witch children often had a lot of distress in their system. But in Sierra Leone, you do not talk about suffering because you're taught from a very young age that you have to bear. You have to bear, and so you shut up. You don't talk about your suffering. What you can talk about, though, is witchcraft. That's a topic that you can talk about. So these children developed a language of witchcraft to talk about their distress and to talk about their suffering, and so did their parents, and so did the church, and everybody went along in a narrative of witchcraft. And the thing is that if you, and I'm going a little bit ahead of myself, but if you then go along in that witchcraft narrative and you deliver the child, often what you see is that everybody is feeling better except for the child. So now everybody feels good because the witch has been delivered, and we have an explanation why I have been suffering, because it's this witch child that caused the suffering. But what you see is that the child itself, ends with depression and is not doing well. So these are just some examples. And now I would like to move a little bit into the next topic of the relevance or irrelevance of our Western diagnosis, because I have had a lot of thoughts about this as I worked in a different context. So I think the first one, what I already mentioned, is the ethnocentricity of the DSM and the ICD. We have to realize that if you look at this, what is described in the DSM is very much based on our experience in the Western setting. So does it mean that, for example, if I have a child in Sierra Leone that hears voices, is that abnormal or is it not abnormal? Maybe it isn't abnormal. Maybe it's okay. Maybe that's a different thing. And if children see things, I have noticed that in Sierra Leone, that's not often considered a mental health problem. That's a spiritual gift. And so how do I, in this context, use the DSM or use a classification system? How do I do any studies on prevalence? Because I don't really know what it looks like in different cultures. The other one is the risk of medicalizing. It's what we've seen, for example, is that people do want to work in a culturally appropriate way. And yet, so for example, in Liberia, there's been a study on the open mold syndrome. That is a syndrome that people express there that they have, and that they discovered was very similar to depression. And so they started now saying that if you had an open mold syndrome, you should go to the nurse and you would be treated with medication. Now, the next problem was now that open mold syndrome is a medical condition and needs to be treated with medication, there is no medication. So we can no longer treat open mold syndrome, which could be treated fine before by the community health worker, by community traditional healers or by pastors. It could no longer be treated because now we need medication for it. So that's a risk if we medicalize problems in other cultures. There's also the risk of individualizing. Once we come with our Western approach and our Western diagnostic systems and we say, well, this child has ADHD, the moment this child has a label, it's expected to be treated, and we then stop looking at the systems. And I don't think that's unique for working in another culture. I think the same thing happens in our culture. We do a lot of labeling of people with mental health disorders and children with mental health disorders, and it stops us from looking at the system around the child, like what is going on there, and it actually is not helpful. And I think that it's more and more realized in the field of psychiatry and mental health, which is a good thing. In general, in the global mental health movement, we see more and more the movement towards a dimensional approach rather than a binary approach. So rather than saying you have depression or you don't have depression, you have autism or you don't have autism, we see it very clearly in the diagnosis of autism. It's now the autism spectrum disorder, so there's a large variety. And this is a very easier way to look at mental health, because, for example, in Sierra Leone, you don't have diagnosis. People don't have words for autism. They don't have words for trauma or for depression. But they do have symptoms, and they can tell you about a child who is, you have SCAT, you have BOSBOS, you have Bonry. Those are different symptoms that children have. And they do describe mental health problems, but not so much a diagnosis. But they are like different clusters of symptoms that are like on a scale. So people there also very much know when it becomes a concern. So it may not be a concern when it's this much, but it becomes a concern when it's this much. And so it's much more a dimensional approach. Yeah. Also, and I've already mentioned this, is the whole new development of neuroscience, that we need to remember that our brain is shaped by our environment. So we cannot just take our research from Western settings and apply it in other settings, because even when it's the brain, it can be very different. Then also, we need to pay attention to the unique symptoms and aspects in different contexts. I'm saying this because I think that even if we have a diagnosis that seems universal like autism, it still can look very different in different cultures. For example, they found that in Africa, children with autism have less or no stereotypic behavior. They may have it, but many children with autism don't have it, and they don't really know yet why, but it definitely is not a very typical symptom. So we may have to really look at what does even autism look in a different cultural context. So what should our approach be as we come in as missionaries? We come into a different culture as missionary doctors or psychologists or social workers or teachers or even as lay workers. What should our approach be? And I think the first one should be we should be humble, because we need to realize that what we have learned may not be very relevant in the context that you're going to work in. And also, but we need to be professional. And I think that's another point that I want to make, that I've seen a lot of people, and I think we see the same in the medical field, go to a different culture. For example, they go to Africa and suddenly they are the expert in a lot of things. And I think that can be very dangerous, especially when it comes to trauma care. You cannot just start treating children for trauma if you do not know much about trauma. You really should be professional as well. Make sure you are trained before you go out in the field. Now, mental health is deeply embedded in culture and religion, and therefore language and culture study. If you are a missionary and you want to work in the field of mental health, you really need to study the culture and you need to study the language and know what's got. Because I've been there 14 years and I've been involved in Shelley. I still go there for over 20 years now, and I still feel sometimes I'm just scratching the surface. I'm not sure what is going on in many situations, even though I live there and I'm beginning to understand a lot more things, picking up on things. Mental health, and we know that ourselves, it's our soul. It's related to the deepest of our being. And so we cannot just use a different language. It's even when we are counseling, if you need to counsel in a different language, it's very hard to do that, because we like to speak about our problems in our heart language. So I would say, yeah, if you want to work in mental health, take time to study the language and the culture. The other point I want to make is acknowledge resilience, because I think it's so easy for us to focus on the problems and to focus on the disorders. But what I've also learned is that people are resilient, and they are actually way more resilient than missionaries are often. I've just been amazed what my Sierra Leonean friends have lived through and how they can cope with situations that I cannot imagine coping with. Just as an example, when I was in Ebola response, I went to a workshop, and there was this woman who had lost 9 children, which is a lot. I'm sure they were her own children and children she was taking care of, to Ebola. And what was she doing? She started composing a song that said, "We have so much to be thankful for." And I was just so humbled, because I was like, who am I to teach her how to deal with trauma? And I mean, I may have my whole education, but these people have lived through it. So I think we should come humbly and also acknowledge that people are resilient and children are resilient. And they can, you know, we come from some of a European or an American perspective, and we can look at situations and think that must be terrible. And it is terrible. And yet these children have seen a lot more than we have often. And so they're able to handle a lot more than we do. And then in line with that is acknowledge local coping mechanisms, because people have found ways to cope with distress. We may feel, and I remember going to a workshop years ago where they said, people need to talk about everything, and we need to make sure that people talk about everything when they have been traumatized. In Sierra Leone, that is not the approach. People do not want to talk about their trauma. So that they may, but many times they don't. And actually, who am I to make them talk about trauma if they have to still survive? Their life is still survival every day. And if I start to talk about that trauma, they may not be able to survive. So we also need to acknowledge and respect local coping mechanisms. And also, I've seen, like, the Ebola response, people coming in with like psychological first aid, which I'm saying it's a good thing. But I heard one of my Sierra Leonean colleagues talking to people, and they say, well, they come with this psychological first aid, and you know, this is what it is, and we already do it. Let me show you how we already do it. And then he proceeded to compare the psychological first aid of WHO with their local grieving practices, which was actually very similar. And they were already doing it, only we gave it professional names. We gave it whatever we call it, but they were already doing it. And so we need to respect that and I think learn about that. We need to ask questions. What are the local explanatory models? We need to ask what local people think is causing their problems, because if we do not address what is causing the problem, then they will not feel healed. So if, for example, if somebody feels that the problem in a child is caused by spirits, we may, or by witchcraft, for example, yes, we can address, we can look, like I said, we can come with a mental health approach and we can treat a child, but we also need to pay attention to the spiritual part of it. And if you do not do that, people will not feel helped. And we also need to, if you want to develop child mental health care, it's good to see where do people seek help typically. Is it from doctors, nurses? Is it maybe from religious people? Is it from teachers? Who are the people that locally are trusted with what's called mental health problems? And I'm not talking about severe mental health problems, but where do people, local people, go if they go through trauma, if they are depressed? Where do they go? And then we should actually, those are the people that we need to empower to provide care or to refer to professional care. Yeah, this is just a little observation. Like, we often think about culture when it comes to like treatment or when it comes to diagnosis. In everything, every aspect, we need to remember as we come as missionaries and we go to a different culture, we need to remember that culture affects everything. So even taking a history, asking about a child's development, I discovered that many people in Sierra Leone, they don't think linear. They tell me things and in a very different order than they happened. But it's important to listen to that. Also, like, because we are trained with our Western mind, for example, we think in terms of very often in very terms of psychology that we've learned, popular psychology. So we will know what the psychologist wants to hear. But these are people that have never before met a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And so they don't really know what's expected. And they don't see connections that we might see. So I interviewed a lot of young people and asked about trauma. Have anything happened to them that was very traumatized, that was very difficult for them? No, not really. And I would look at their age and I would say, well, so where were you during the war? Oh. And then the stories would come. But for them, it was nothing. It was something that everybody went through. Why would you talk about war as a trauma, as something that could be traumatic, if everybody has experienced it? So I really had to learn to ask more questions. And another important attitude I feel is that we should not judge. And it's sometimes very easy to become very distressed about what we find, what we see. For example, I have children in my program that are tied to a tree at home. They are down in the villages and they have no care and they're still tied to the tree, but I hope as they stay in our program that they won't anymore. But these are not parents that don't care. These are parents that are poor. And so you have a child with autism who goes around the village and breaks people's things and destroys, and it's just quite destructive in their behavior. And so the people from the village come to the parents and ask them to pay. And the parents can't afford that. So what can they do? They have to go and work on the farm. They cannot be with their child 24/7. So the only way that they can manage is to tie their child to a tree. And it doesn't mean they don't love them. And I had to really see that yes, these parents love their children and they do the best they can. And it sometimes means that they have to lock up their child. And it's not, it is, okay, maybe it is abusive, but it isn't in a sense that this was done out of love. Because they could have left their child in the bush, which many people will advise them to do. Just leave your child, let them die. And that's what they don't want to do. Just a few suggestions about if you were thinking about mental health, child mental health interventions. The first thing is, as much as possible, work through local providers. Don't, as a missionary, yes, you may be able to help, but if you can find local people who understand the culture, who speak the language, and you can train and educate them, in the first place, you can do so much more. In the second place, it's probably much more relevant because they understand the culture. In the third place, it's much more sustainable because also when you leave, this will continue. So, for example, at the hospital I worked in, I was able to train nurses and community health workers in rape counseling because there were a lot of rape cases. And now they can counsel the girls. And if I don't have to be around, I also don't understand the full culture about around sexual abuse, which is a very complicated culture of sexual abuse. And I don't understand everything. The nurses understand much better. And so they can provide better care, but they can also continue to provide it, and I'm not there. So again, aim for sustainability. If you are considering short-term work, it should always be embedded, I would should say, and it should support local structures. So rather than going and loading your art supplies and going and do trauma care in wherever you want to do it, and then flying out again, you are not really helping. It's very risky, and it's also not building a local capacity. So always try to make your work build, like try to empower what is there. I've already mentioned this before, avoid medicalization. Medication is often unnecessary and it's often unavailable. So there's no way to treat ADHD with medication in Sierra Leone. So what else can we do? How else can we help these children? There are ways to help them. And also, if we do begin to introduce medication, there's also a danger when you train people and you give them very short training. I've seen people who have like 6 weeks training in basic mental health skills, and they are treating like children who are stammering because they are distressed for whatever reason, they are stammering, and they're treating them with haloperidol. And that's not the way to go. So as I would say, try to avoid medicalization. The toolbox approach is a new movement, basically, to say, rather, it goes back to the dimensional approach of mental health. So rather than thinking in terms of diagnosis, look at symptoms. So there's a lot of symptoms that we see them across diagnoses. So if you can find, for example, relaxation technique can be a toolbox, can be a tool out of the toolbox. Relaxation techniques, they can work for people with depression, they can work for children with anxiety, they can work for trauma, so they work across different diagnoses. So rather than training people how to diagnose, train them how to deal with different symptoms and give them a toolbox of skills that they can use across different diagnoses. Cultural adaptation is so important, and I want to say it's more than just translation. And it's more than, like, I was reading through some tools that were developed, and I thought the only thing that they have changed in this is they have introduced an African drum in the intervention. And now it's suddenly a Sierra Leonean intervention. No, it's not. It was a very Western intervention, and it was translated, and yes, we have an African drum in there, but it doesn't mean it's now an African intervention. So we should not be lazy. We should really try to learn what works in this culture. And we should look at, like, what are the elements that we need to hold on to that are very important in an intervention, but how can we then adapt them to this culture? Be aware of same language pitfalls. Sierra Leone is, English is the main language. And so I've seen a psychologist, for example, doing a training, and she was standing in front of a group of young men, and she said, has anybody here ever felt disappointed? And everybody was just sitting there and staring and not saying anything. And she was raising her hand like, I have been disappointed. And in Sierra Leone, yes, disappointed is a word they know, that they learn in school, but it just only refers to being disappointed, being treated badly by a woman, by a girlfriend. So you're not going to say, I've been disappointed, because you're too proud to say that. But also, it's not, they don't know the concept of disappointment. You need to find another word for that. So even if you speak the same language, it doesn't mean that you can communicate about mental health. Then also cultural values and expectations of children. That's very important, because we need to know what is expected of children. And what are strong values. So, for example, if we encourage children to express their emotions, they might go back to a home where that is not appreciated. There's not many homes in Sierra Leone where it's appreciated if a child tells a parent that I'm very upset with you because you're doing this or that, which we probably would encourage children to say, to tell their parents. But if you do that, you might actually make things worse. So if you do that, you need to also include the parents in the, and it's, you should always do that, always include the family. And that's the last, okay. And also, like, trying to find out, like, what is your goal in, for example, if you do a therapeutic intervention, what is your goal? What do you want? So then you need to find out locally, what does a healthy teenage girl look like? And what is expected of her in this society? So that should be our goal. And it might be very different from what you're used to. It might be something you may not even approve of. And yet that's what your goal should be, because she has to live in this society. And so she has to work towards that goal. And the last one, yeah, always include families and communities. I think we've all learned that it takes a village to raise a child and also to treat a child. We need everybody included. Very briefly, in mental health, it's very, these days we talk a lot about working with traditional healers and working with religious healers like pastors. I think as Christians, we have a lot of reservations automatically about working with traditional healers. But that's where people go. So what are some of the things you need to remember when this is suggested to us? We should not romanticize working with traditional healers or religious healers, and I'm saying both, because I've also seen abuse. There's a big danger of abuse, high danger of abuse, and I've seen that both with traditional healers and with pastors. There's a high risk of sexual abuse, and there's also physical abuse. There is, like, many pastors make children fast, for example, for many days on no food, no drink, no water. So we have to be very careful and be very, you know, careful who we work with. So don't romanticize working with traditional and religious healers. But on the other hand, observe and find out what works and why, and can it be adapted? The psychiatrist I did my PhD under, he was not a Christian, but he said there are certain things that can be treated better by traditional healers than by psychiatrists. And, for example, I think it was somatoform disorders. They treat that very well. They do very well. The outcomes are really good. I think we need to observe, what are these people doing, and are there things that are not, there's nothing wrong with it, that we can actually adapt. And that we can. So the man I work with in Sierra Leone, the one who's leading our program there, he actually recently told me a very interesting story. And he said he was walking through his community and he met this girl who was just crying. And he's like, what is going on? So he went up to her and the other children and they said, well, her grandfather died and he comes to her. She sees him. And as he was there, she was, look, he's there. And she was pointing and he looked and there was nobody there. And so what he did, he from a nearby house, he said, does anybody have some water? And he took the water and he prayed over it. And he washed the face of the child. And the child immediately was better. And I know, you know, there's many questions you can ask here, but I thought it was so interesting because washing your face is traditionally a very common thing that people do. That healers do, that older grandmothers do for their grandchildren when there are problems. So you wash the face, and this was somebody so symbolic and so strong for this child and for this family that she actually was a lot better after that. But was it actually the washing of the face? Was it God doing this? Was it him actually showing interest in this child and listening to her and showing care and compassion? What made her feel better? I don't know what it was, but I thought it was an amazing way of him adapting something that's common in the culture. And he is Sierra Leonean, so he can do that and helping this child. I also want to caution here, like, what is a Christian worldview? I've seen many people come to Africa and immediately think that the moment they hear the mention of spirits and demons, that this is the biblical worldview, which it can be, but it can also not be, because a lot of the animistic worldviews are not biblical. And so you have to be very careful in going along the narrative, even of Christian people. It's good to get a look at what does actually scripture say. And so, for example, the whole narrative of witchcraft and children and witchcraft, I've seen many people just accepting this, and I think we need to look at scripture. Is this actually a very scriptural concept that children can actually become witches and wreak havoc? So, but I do think we need to remember that religious healers and traditional healers, they can play an important role in stigma reduction. So that's connected to the next one, the roles of the local church, before we end. I think the local church can play an important role in educating people about mental health. What I see in Sierra Leone, that actually the church is often perpetuating the stigma by saying, if you are a woman and you sin, then you will give birth to a child, for example, who has autism, and the pastors will tell you this from the pulpit. So we need to educate the church, and they then can educate the people in their churches. Church can model positive parenting, and I'm not saying that we need to take our Western ideas about parenting and take them to Asia or Africa, wherever we are going, but we can encourage the church together. But in this cultural context, what does good parenting look like? The church can also provide lay counselors, because a lot of mental health problems, if you remember the pyramid, a lot of mental health problems, even in children and adolescents, can be addressed by simply becoming a friend and listening and providing a safe place for children. And then also the church can in many ways help with practical support for parents of children with mental health problems. Thinking of the children that are tied to trees, can the church do something and say, I will watch your child while you go to the farm so you don't have to tie her to a tree? There's many ways that the church can help in practical ways. Thank you. This was my talk. Any questions and comments? I also put my email address at the bottom if you have any questions, or you would like any more, you're interested in like more training in this field and you'd like to have some suggestions, or I can also help out with that, but also refer you to places that provide training. So thank you. Any questions? Yes. Yeah, just for the recording, so they're asking, there's many cultures, physically disabled children are hidden away, and yes, we see the same with children with mental health problems, that they're often kept hidden from the world because of their problems. Then you're talking about the severe mental health issues, like intellectual disabilities or like the classic autism, but of course, if you're talking about children with trauma or children with ADHD, what we call, I would say, ADHD or OCD, these children often are in the community, but they're often abused. There's a high risk of them being beaten a lot in school and discriminated against.
Yeah. What is your suggestion for if you find that a child is hidden away, how to draw that child out for better care?
If a child is hidden away,
how can we help to draw the child out for better care?
Yeah, how can we help these children? I think that it starts with the parents, it starts with the community, and educating them on what mental health problems are, and educating them why this child is behaving the way it's behaving, and then start from there, and providing care, practical care, because they need practical care, because it's so easy for us to judge, and it's very difficult to manage an autistic child in America, let alone in a small village, so we need a lot of support for that. And we are, in my own program, we are actually going to the villages and we are working with the parents and counseling them and giving them suggestions. We have a daycare program so people can bring their children during the day and then go so they can find food for their family and then at the end of the day pick up their child again. So, yeah. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for a very helpful overview and practical from your perspective with training and the long view of mental health care and understanding. We've got a lot of students here, and I'm wondering, besides writing you directly, can you give just a sketch of what might be a way into care globally, mental health, as a Christian, what might be effective pathways?
Yeah, thank you for that question. What's an effective pathway? I must say that it's hard because it's such a young field, so there's not a whole lot available yet. So I would say, first of all, get trained in this context. Get your training, get some experience, that's very important. Get trained in cross-cultural ministry, understanding cultures, knowing what kind of like, take some anthropology classes, because that it's so important to be able to look at cultures from an anthropological perspective, know what questions to ask, what to look for. And then I would say there's not many, to be honest, in America especially, I don't think there's any, I'm not aware of any cross-cultural child mental health training program. I don't think there is. At the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands, they have now a professor in a global child mental health, so it's beginning there. There's though a lot of literature around, so if you just find like there's good, like the, there's, yeah, I don't know offhand, but there's different journals that are really good. Yes, you want to comment on?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Oh, okay. Now, there's different journals that are actually really good and have some good research. So if you just Google that, basically, then you will find some papers. But yeah, a lot of it, and I think that it's such a new field that we need to develop it together, and we need to, because especially the whole area of spirituality and child mental health, which to me is even different from spirituality and adult mental health, because we come with the whole, children are so vulnerable, and children are, so I think certain things that we may apply to adult mental health disorders, I'm not sure we can apply them to child mental health disorders, and also children, they're in a different position. So I think we still need to develop together. So I would love to actually get in touch with people who do that, so we can do some thinking together, and also just to start developing this field. Yeah. So. Yes.
So my question is about like SSRIs. Like mm-hmm. I've been to some places where they sell it like over the counter,
oh, yeah.
like really accessible. Mm-hmm. Is that like a good solution for like?
You know, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I would say no, because yeah, I definitely think that we should, you know, I see in Chile there's no psychotropic medication available over the counter, but I can just see how disastrous this is in general health, like, you know, they sell antibiotics, everything over the counter. And I've seen how when like some haloperidol is available, how it's then just fed to anybody who has any distress. So I think we need to be so careful with that. So I would not think that's a good solution. I think it's much more important that we give people skills to deal with depression and trauma and anxiety in ways that are not medical and don't require medication. And I think, you know, we've become so medicalized I see that especially as a European coming to America, I'm even like here going like, I can't believe it how many people are giving medication. And I've seen from experience how much can be done, even working with severely mentally ill people, how much better they do once you give them structure and meals and care and love and interest. They do, even if they have psychosis, they do already a lot better with just that. And I've been amazed what happens when you do that. So I would say much more it could be medical, but if you can avoid medication, I think it's much more sustainable and healthy. Yeah.
Well, just a question. In your email, your name is spelled H-E-L-E-E-N.
That's correct, because I'm Dutch, and that's the Dutch way of spelling Helene. So, yes. Yes.
I had a question. I mean, I'm curious to know a little bit more. I mean, obviously, in the American context, in terms of, like, children and adolescents and how they're influenced by, like, media and their culture, how that influences their development.
Yeah.
Do you see any of that in the context that you've been in?
Oh, definitely. I think, you know, that we can't stop the global developments, and smartphones are everywhere. So it definitely has an impact on even in countries like Sierra Leone, on how young people develop. And there's an interesting book that I actually have it in my bag, but it's called Crazy Like Us. Has anybody read that book? It's called Crazy Like Us. It's a bit older, but it's maybe 2016, and it's talking about the globalization of mental health problems from America. You crazy like us could also be the US, and how diagnoses like anorexia and depression have actually spread over the world, and the global developments and the role also of the pharmaceutical industry in that. But yeah, I mean, for example, a lot of young people in Sierra Leone, they watch pornography on their phones, and they do not understand that that is not what is normal. And so we've seen a lot of problems with that, where young girls get terribly abused because they see on their phones what gets done, and they feel like that's normal, and they should be able to live up to those standards, and it can be terrible. So it definitely has an impact, yeah. Any other? Time is about up, but yes.
Yeah, so you alluded to a lot of your patients having, like, difficult home lives and trauma. What was your approach if you, like, uncovered that a child would be, like, badly abused at home? Like, does Sierra Leone have something equivalent to DCS, or...?
So, when a child is abused at home, it's, like, I can give you one example. I had a little boy that came to my house, and he was terribly beaten up. His skin was just basically gone from his thighs, and he was just... So, you know, this, I was like, where do I start? But what I did, I started with the community. So I started with the parents, and then also involve the community. And everybody in the community agreed that the father had, or the uncle had gone too far with this child, had abused him too much. So I got community elders to talk to the uncle. And I very closely monitored the child at home and also worked with the aunt and the uncle. So I took a community approach and an individual approach. You can go to the police. It doesn't make much of a difference. Sometimes it's done to sort of threaten the parents, but in some ways it's much more important. I also kind of tried to find out what made them abuse this child so severely, and there were like things about the child that they didn't understand. So you do also psychoeducation, and you help them understand the behavior of the child. And so it's a very, you know, you use different approaches. Yeah. And it's much more accepted there. Like, you know, it's very easy to get others involved. There's not all this confidentiality. It sounds bad, but sometimes that's a good thing if you can involve the community in the prevention of abuse. Yeah.
So you mentioned that, like, you were there for, like, 6 weeks, and then you already met, like, a girl, and, like, I'm sure there was urges to, like, fix the problem right away.
Yeah.
But could you speak as in terms of, like, timeline when mm-hmm. you go somewhere, like, a year, 2 years learning, maybe, and then before you start, like, implementing things?
Well, that's very hard to know, because every culture is different, and every, you know, it takes sometimes much longer. But I think if you can work with local people who are willing to ask you critical questions and give you critical feedback, I think it will go faster, but you have to find some people who can. When I worked in Ebola response, I remember there was a psychologist that flew in from the US, and she had been there like 2 weeks or so, and she had all these interventions, and she wanted to do like the children to do meditation and imagine they were an animal. And I said, I don't think that's a good idea, because children actually think that children can change into animals. So if you're going to do this intervention where they have to imagine to be an animal, they may actually be in trouble now, because people think that, you know, this child is trying to change into a cat or a dog. And so she looked at me and she said, nobody told me this. And I said, no, they will not, because you are a white woman and you have a lot of money. And so they will not say anything critical. They will just follow what you say, and they will implement the intervention like you say, but it will not do any good and might actually do more harm. So, but if you have built up good relationships and you tell people, I want you to tell me if this is not suitable for your culture. Now, you might find some people that will do that, and then you can move a lot faster, because they will help you understand the culture, and then let them do it. Don't do it yourself, but let them do it. Yeah, it's a good question. Thank you. Well,
I wanted to piggyback on a question from the young lady back here talking about medicinal treatments, particularly when you're in a developing country, especially for all of these students who have not done international missionary work yet before. Understanding these are the poorest of the poor countries, like the absolute poorest. I was in Sierra Leone earlier this year for a month. They can't afford medicine. We can hop down to the pharmacy and buy metformin for all the diabetes we diagnose. You're lucky if they sell one pineapple a day on the side of the road to feed their family. One pineapple. And you're going to see that when you go to other developing countries as well. I was in the bush in many, many towns in Sierra Leone, and they would test their urine if it was sweet. How we used to diagnose diabetes. That's what they have for diagnosing diabetes. What are you going to do for it? Nothing. You have to understand that they cannot afford treatment. And so what Helene was talking about is educating them on diet, something like that. All they can afford is white rice, super high in the glycemic index, so you're going to further their diabetes. But say, hey, plant some more legumes. See if you can do some more peppers. Try to have a more plant-based diet. Maybe lower your rice intake. Just understanding that when you're in the poorest of the poor countries, medication management usually isn't an option because there's no continuation of care. There's no one to oversee it, but more importantly, there's no one to pay for it. There's no way for them to get into a local village or a town to even go to a pharmacy to pick the medication. That's not an option if you're in a developing country.
Thank you for that contribution, because that's definitely very true. Yeah. It's time, so I want to close in prayer, and then if anybody wants to talk more, I'm available. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, there are so many hurting children in this world, and if you think of what we learned this morning, we know that you are with them and that you are beckoning us to come near these children. Lord Jesus, when there are people in this room that you are calling, I pray that they will come close to these children to give them the hope of salvation, but also the the healing of a heart that's healed by you. And so we pray that you will continue to guide and direct everybody who's in this room, and that they will depend on you in all things. We thank you that you will guide them, that you will make it clear to them. And so we trust in that. And we thank you for your great love, and we thank you for all these children that you see and that you care about. And we thank you that you can do more than we can ever imagine. So we thank you for that, and we commit ourselves into your loving and capable hands in Jesus' name.